Welcome to episode 147 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including doing a barrel roll. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uwasa. I think you might be talking about the platform, the R-Wing, if I'm not mistaken there. Lots of news about that to come.
Yes, absolutely. Another week, another few courses of gaming news and discussions coming up. So how are you doing, Mark?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. It was kind of like intense day of family hanging out. It was Mother's Day, just on the day of this recording. All of the family stuff went fine. And then my youngest decided that they, to let us know they'd volunteered us for some extracurricular projects. So we're in the kitchen making boba pearls from scratch. It's like, this is the last thing we needed to do on Mother's Day evening. But hey, this is what you have to do for your family, I guess.
The joy of being parents is they decide what they're rewarding you with, I guess.
I guess so. When they're rewarding you, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not too bad. And yourself?
Yeah. Pretty easy day here. So I actually had half a day yesterday by myself. So I was actually able to catch up on a few gaming projects. So yeah, I guess we'll get straight to it for the appetizer today. What's in your mind, Mark?
Yeah, I just have a couple of stories that interested me. I don't know about these a lot. One of them I'll just start with is actively in development, so I guess that's why we don't know a lot. So apparently there's a bit of a spitting match between the owner or owners of the Wizardry franchise. So Wizardry is one of the older computer RPG titles that are out there, and they we OmniGamers will recall that we have mentioned it quite often when we've been talking about Japanese RPGs, so JRPGs. Wizardry is still an active series in Japan and is very popular, has a large legacy, almost nearly as big as Dragon Quest or Final Fantasy. So it's very much a real thing there, kind of forgotten on the wayside in North America with other more popular series like The Elder Scrolls over here. But anyways, there's a bit of a fight. So American company Atari, who suspiciously sounds like a Japanese company, apparently has purchased the IP rights from the original creator and for the first five games in the series. And I don't even know how many games there are, but there's quite a bit more than five, as I understand it. So that was on May the 6th when they made that announcement. And then on May the 7th, a Japanese publisher, Dracom, announced that they had acquired the copyright and trademark rights for Wizardry, suspiciously, way back in 2020. And that, contrary to Atari's claims, that they continue to own and manage the IP rights. And then more recently, there was an update to that article, and Atari just kind of spat back a simple response. We own the rights to the first games, first five games. So it's going back and forth. I don't know who's in the right here, but I just know that it's kind of messy business, and it'll be interesting to see how that IP war maps out.
Yeah, I hadn't followed that particular bit of news. You'd think that the original rights holder would be able to clarify who they sold it to, I guess.
Yeah, I guess if the original rights holder sold it away, then, of course, they wouldn't have the right to sell it again. Be kind of like, you know, George Lucas coming back and saying, hey, I'll give you a deal on Star Wars real cheap if you give me the right price, right?
A lot of these rights often also are obviously limited to particular regions of it too, so that could be complicating things. Curiously, I was just reading an article from Rascal recently about some localization of some Japanese TTRPGs, which I'd been to talk about on the show, but wasn't able to squeeze it in. But there was some discussion there from people wanting to localize. I guess there's also a TTRPG based on the Wizardry series. I assume it's by the same name. I assume they're connected at least.
Yeah, quite possibly. Although it is not in dispute that Wizardry originally was an American PC game title. It's a computer RPG title that was ported to Japan. And then, like many a one-hit wonder band from the 80s, was bigger in Japan than anywhere else. So it continues to live on there. Yeah, I personally don't have a lot of interaction and knowledge and first-hand experience with it. I just know of the kind of the legacy and that it's very much in the like kind of first-person dungeon crawling mode, kind of like Phantasy Star 1 that you and I had played a lot of recently.
But much more rudimentary. It's like wire mesh. There's not really any textures or anything. It's just like you're seeing the wireframe settings as you go through the dungeons.
Yeah, and unlike a lot of JRPGs that would follow, that would later kind of form the modern concept of JRPGs, Wizardry is very much a CRPG. It's like you make characters, you define their classes and their, you know, their ancestries and whatever, and they're very much not like pre-designed, like Final Fantasy X characters that have their own poster art and whatever. These are like, you make it from scratch, you play a CRPG from scratch and just crawl that dungeon, baby.
Excellent. Yeah, I think there was a remake of at least the first game a couple of years ago, I want to say, that I've been meaning to get to. I've heard that's that was a much more, it was a complete recall remake and into a modern graphics engine. So I'm going to be curious to check that out.
Yeah, there have been quite a few more modern remakes, and I'm sure if anyone's curious, you can check them out on Steam or even on places like Switch and mobile devices too.
Excellent.
How about yourself, Daniel?
Well, talking of remakes of older games, there was a surprise announcement this week of a new Star Fox game. Well, at least a new remake of an old Star Fox game that I guess most listeners will know of as Star Fox 64. I actually grew up knowing it as Lylat Wars. Apparently that was the name in the PAL regions. But Nintendo have announced that they're basically completely remaking that game from scratch. I believe it has been available on Nintendo Online. But Mark, have you played the original game?
I definitely have played the Super Nintendo Star Fox. I must have played it on N64, but I only had a passing interest in the Star Fox games. I thought they were a little, I don't know, shallow, I guess, gameplay-wise. It kind of felt like one of those like amusement park rides where you could like go left slightly or go right slightly, and it's like a shooting gallery, you know, rather than a in-depth game of its own right.
It was rather novel at the time, sort of branching paths and the sort of challenges and secrets you had to do to unlock those different paths. The thing being, once you'd found those secrets, like, it's the same every time. There's not really much divergence. So there wasn't much in terms of replayability. I do wonder how much of that there is, like how much more replayability they can squeeze out of it. Apparently they're adding like some different difficulty modes, some challenges for each level, completely rehauled graphics and like with cutscenes. Characters, I will say, like, do have a lot of expressivity, and like there's a lot of gravitas to those characters, animal people or not. It seems like they're doing a good job with the characters there, at least.
Yeah, I watched the entire Nintendo Direct, so I saw all those details as well. Still not terribly exciting to me to have like kind of random extra objectives pasted onto a kind of rinse and repeat kind of level structure. It's decidedly old school, let's just say. And you know, for some reason the Star Wars dogfighting games can always get away with being stuck on this very limited area and only being able to travel within this very small spherical area before you had to cycle right back. I don't know if you remember Shadows Over the Empire or whatever on the N64 had a very, very tight geography on that Hoth level where they had to spin right back when you reach the edge of the perimeter. Anyways, I guess on Star Wars, it feels more natural because usually it's like a battle happening around one of those Star Destroyers or something like that. So it seems natural that you would want to be focused on a tight area. Star Fox never really did it for me. I think I've seen the new character models for the characters, and they certainly do look evocative, but strangely enough they aren't even on design level with the Star Fox entry in the latest Mario movie.
Yeah, I've seen some people complaining about the new character design, sort of an ultra realistic art style rather than the really more stylized versions we've seen in like Super Smash Brothers and the Mario movie. And I haven't seen that movie yet, but that was a pretty dire cutscene, I thought, just like reducing all those characters down to sort of a real meathead pilot and just like the irreverency and like very wishy-washy. I don't know.
Not very inspiring writing. And yeah, you're right. The animals kind of like look creepy, like the Wes Anderson animal puppet movies of late. Just not very bright and colorful and cheerful like the original. So I don't know really who this is for. It seems like it's not really entirely for the old school, and I don't think it's going to satisfy the new school fans. So
I mean, I'm definitely curious to go back. I'm certainly not willing to pay $80 for it. I'm not sure what the price range, what the price point is going to be just yet. I will see. I have heard some rumors that this is sort of just wetting people's whistle for a new, truly new Star Fox game, which has been a long time since we've had. I still want to go back and check out Star Fox Adventures, a sort of platforming game with dinosaurs. I missed that. I didn't have a GameCube at the time. So I'm hoping that comes to Nintendo Online sometime soon.
Yeah, I'd hold your breath for that. We'll see. Nintendo seems to like to milk out these franchises quite a bit wherever possible. All right, so I'll talk about my next news story. This time it's TTRPG related, not computer RPG related. This one has to do with the TTRPG Cortex Prime, which is a little bit of a not well understood RPG system. I personally haven't read the manual thoroughly, although I did get a copy of, I think, two editions of Cortex at the latest TCTC. There was a nice sale. The price was right. So I snatched those up quite happily. So I do own Cortex Prime, which was released sometime in like 2015 or something like that. So it's been a little while for that series. The core concept of the series is that make it like a fundamental framework and then add these optional modules that you can kind of plug in to make an RPG slightly more in this direction or that direction. And of note, Cortex has been used as the kind of framework foundation for some licensed TTRPGs of the last few years, like, I think, what was it called? The Marvel Heroic role-playing system. Mm-hmm. I think that was in 2012 that came out. And 10 years later, Tales of Zadia, the Netflix Dragon Prince TV show tie-in RPG book was done in the Cortex Prime system. So, you know, it has been around and I guess just doesn't never reach that kind of like household name level that even some other RPG systems like Cypher and things have, or Savage Worlds, just never reached that level. But I think the promise of the system is very interesting. And basically the news story is that over the last 10, 15 years, basically, this guy Cam Banks has kind of been shepherding the game system on and off. He led the development of the second game after a person called Jamie Chambers developed it in 2010 originally, and kind of has shepherded different editions of it till this point. It's gone through different ownerships. I think it was sold to like Fandom at some point, the website maker for some reason, and then Direwolf of Direwolf Digital fame, makers of things like Clank and Eternal online PC CCG that I like to play. They put out a bunch of stuff and they owned it for a while too. Apparently they still own it, but the Cam Banks has reached a kind of a licensing arrangement and they've agreed to open it up for potentially new edition sub-licensing deals. So there's going to be like community projects primarily for digital distribution on platforms like DriveThruRPG. So I'm hopeful that with this new kind of energy infused into it, that maybe they can kind of repackage it and resell it with some new IP tie-ins, maybe have a new edition of the core rulebook, and maybe it'll finally kind of break that glass ceiling and reach wider acclaim. Because it just seems like the little kind of little RPG engine that could, and always struck me as fascinating.
Yeah, I can't say I'm familiar with that engine. I mean, that sort of plug and play nature. I mean, I can certainly see the appeal, but it only is useful if you're already familiar with that system, right? Like the benefit of plug and play is having that core understanding that you can plug other things into. So if it hasn't got that widespread appeal, it's a harder sell, obviously. Not to say that it's not without its benefits, obviously. I'm not familiar with that system. Do you know much about what it does well?
I have read a few chapters in passing. I think what would really help it work is if they could popularize like just the core skeleton of it, you know? Another system that has done this fairly well is the system called Fate. They've done it in a bit of a messy way. They have different editions of Fate. They have things like Fate Core, Fate Classic, and then they've sold licensed versions of Fate that have come with their own settings and worlds. But fundamentally, the bones of it are really solid and simple. And then they essentially have sold like editions that are variations on that. I think Cortex is a little bit different. They're selling you the modular components, kind of like a Lego set where you can kind of plug in different bits and chunks to maybe change your fantasy RPG into a more sci-fi friendly one, or more like make your action adventure RPG more like a kind of a social deduction angle. I think you can really change the flavor and taste of it. And it might even be easier to sell your RPG playing group on a different flavor of the system if they already know the fundamentals of the rule set. That's my hope. Anyways, maybe that's a big promise, but I'm hopeful. You know, the game system has already lasted this long already, over 15 years. So there has to be something there.
Oh. Okay. Well, not so much news, but that's sort of a topic that I wanted to dive into for a couple of minutes. I did assign you a little bit of recommended reading. I know you didn't get all the way through this, but I saw an article a couple of weeks ago on Remap Radio called Who Cares About the Law? Duncan Fife was the writer contracted for that over there. And there was also a companion podcast that was also similarly interesting, though I don't know if those are available sort of, I think they're behind a paywall, I will say. But, I mean, obviously I recommend you checking those out, but I did also just open up some interesting conversations that I've been thinking about. Last week, I obviously talked about Morrowind and some sort of games inspired by that I've been checking out. But this article was about Morrowind and some of the creators behind it and their approach to lore, which I thought was an interesting way of approaching what made that game tick. Specifically, Ken Rolston and Michael Kirkbride, some of the other creators there, and how they basically had been brought in to, I mean, the original like Arena and Daggerfall were pretty wide games, like huge sprawling sandboxes. A lot of that being procedural generation and fairly vanilla in tone, but these other new creators had been brought in and basically given free rein over this setting. And I think it was a little bit of a sort of low expectations, like this was still a relatively niche series without the expectations of going mainstream, and so they're pretty much given free rein to just do with it what they will. And then obviously some inconsistencies came up, like how you resolve the seven different endings of Daggerfall and the different visions that these creators had. And basically the approach was that inconsistencies don't really matter, and that I think that explore some interesting ideas behind the concept of lore as this sort of authorial voice. And, you know, we've all seen TV shows with the show Bible and this very canonical sense. Obviously, you just mentioned fandom earlier, well, catalog, you know, Wikipedia and things like that. You know, this intricate detail of every single thing and picking out all the inconsistencies and complaining about things that don't match. And basically, this article is breaking down, like, some ways in which it's okay when things don't make sense, when you don't understand them, when there's inconsistencies, and sort of living in that mystery of allowing the lore to be interesting more than consistent, I guess. We've seen things like the Star Wars Extended Universe, and like when Disney took over and they basically, I think, was it called the Extended Universe? I think they changed the name of that at some point to basically eradicate all those novels that had been written.
Yeah, they have done a thing which other long-running series have actually taken up, which is they've introduced the legends. Yes. This is a really interesting concept where basically there's canon on one side and then there's the apocrypha on the other side, right? So legends falls under, here are things that might have happened, but they didn't officially happen. So I actually really like that move. I don't care for like the kind of canonization of the canon, because I think it's more interesting when you don't know what the truth is, right? No, there is no one definitive telling of the Greek gods, right? There are thousands of different versions of all of those stories. And sometimes a character is a brother or uncle or cousin or nephew of the same character in a different version of the story. And maybe that's true just because of funky godlike conjoining. But most of the times it's because different people told it on different days based on the level of drunkenness. And I think it's cooler that there are these whispered versions that people argue about and say, no, this version is better. No, this version is true. I mean, even the Bible has four different versions of the Gospels. So
that's the ones that are written down.
Like, if you can't say that's the good book, if they can't get it down to one version, then what does it matter that there's a definitive version? And I suppose that that's what you're saying that article was. I couldn't get through it because the writer was being very, very precious with their examples about, oh, my dear Laura, you've hurt my feelings.
I think that was actually, that opening was one designer who had been brought on with that concept and was basically repudiated and had left the company because he got too caught up on the law being important. I think Douglas Goodall, I want to say his name was. But to me, this brings to mind games like Mass Effect or Assassin's Creed. You know, you hit select and here's the encyclopedia that explains all of the history and the different planets and the different characters and has this real authorial voice of like, this is what this setting is. Like, you got your tome of the Wheel of Time, your fantasy tome, and you flip to the back and there's the appendix and reading on the history. And that just has always bored me, to be honest. And what really is special about games like Morrowind is like how the history isn't exact. There is no, it's not a monolithic authorial voice. It is presented by the characters living in that world. It is inconsistent. It's just perspectives and interpretations of that history. And it's a living history. And I've always found that so much more interesting. Even if I don't entirely understand it, I think there's an excellent quote from Ken Rolston. I said, I don't think I've ever really enjoyed anything that I've really understood. And I think that sort of sums up how I've enjoyed that.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with what you said. And I think fans of other long-running series like Star Trek, like the Shadowrun novels, like the Battletech novels, which I've also read lately, should take up the banner of Legends, because maybe those versions of the stories that are now in the Apocrypha are more interesting than the official ones that are sanctified by whatever IP-owning body happens to own the franchise at the current moment.
Yeah, funny. I've been thinking about Star Trek, and even within one show like Next Generation that I've been watching, like you have different writers on each episode, and there's going to be inconsistencies between the way those characters are performed and their characters acting out of character, if you know what I mean. Like they're basically roles that are playing a part for whatever that current story needs of them, essentially. And consistency in canon isn't always the priority there.
Yeah, I think maybe the most interesting example that I can think of is a long-running series like The Simpsons, where the characters never age. So essentially, Marge and Homer have had 5 or 6 different versions of them getting together as a couple in different eras and decades, because at the beginning they were getting together in the 70s or 80s, and nowadays they're getting together in the 90s or the 2000s, based on how old their children are, then they should be this old back in this decade, based on the date that the episode aired, right? So those have to have different sets of lore concurrently while the show's still running. I mean, it's an impossible task to keep straight.
No, there's a lot of cool ideas to discuss in terms of lore versus folklore versus history versus archaeology that I've been thinking of it as. I don't want to hold this up too long. We've got a lot of else to discuss, but I just found that a fascinating discussion. So I'll put the links to the article and the podcast in the show notes.
It's a good topic. And, you know, when we're talking about just a little sidebar, if you're talking about doing an RPG or playing a video game within the span of lore, then you want to find those interesting little pockets where an interesting story could take place. I mean, don't we play within the pillars of what's been defined? That's the space where we have the freedom to play.
One final quote from that article: the meaning is all in taking parts, rather than lore being this non-interactive thing that's thrown at you.
Sanctimony. Exactly. I don't believe in it. All right, let's that was a fun intro. Do you have any more news bits?
No, I think we'll leave it there. I've got a few other topics to discuss.
Cool. All right, let's move into meatier subjects, although that was pretty meaty itself. You have a few games to discuss this week?
Just a couple, I think. I'll go first, just because I was going to revisit a game from last week. You talked about Far Lone Sails, and I had said that I'd played a little bit of that before dropping it along with Game Pass. Turns out I did own that game all along, so I rebooted it back up, and I just started it again. It's only like a 3-hour game.
You know, most people do. They actually just hand it out when you reach a certain age nowadays.
It was like $2 on Switch last week, apparently. It's a steal.
Just buy it.
We did discuss it in detail last week, but just a couple of extra takeaways that I wanted to throw out there is that, for one thing, it's just a beautiful looking game. I think the visual design is really strong. It's fairly gray, which like feels like a diss on it, but it's like lots of shades of gray that really utilize the strong effect of like silhouettes and just gradual changes of the color palettes, and then using basically red as highlights for like both your player character and interactable elements. And I think this is a strong visual language in that game.
Yeah, it's very like painterly and also very kind of like oil paintery. Like everything's very like streaky and kind of impressionistic in how it's defined, and kind of appreciate that because the game like is not very precise. It, like, you're zoomed in or you're zoomed out and things are happening, but a lot of the time you don't know what's going on, and it's like the vibes. So I think that kind of strong painterly look works for the story they're trying to tell.
Yeah, and I mentioned recently in regards to Metroid Prime how you sort of lose something in that 3D space, and when you can look wherever you want to, like have free control, you lose some of that situational awareness that like these 2D games are especially good at, sort of directing you and holding you, framing a particular area of the game and what you can see at any one time, I think. And so it's a very cinematic sense. It's a very hand-holdy, obviously, technique, but it's a beautiful way, like guided experience as you go through this game. And I've also been playing a little bit of Planet of Lana 2, which I am enjoying, but put into perspective that Far Lone Sails has no cutscenes. There are no cuts whatsoever. It is just one contiguous experience from A to B. And not to say that's inherently better, but I think when done well, that is really effective. I just love that sense of like there's no cuts, like it's just, you see the whole thing, it's one long take essentially.
Yeah, and that's even all the more fascinating. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but later on there's some sequences where like some very dramatically larger events happen around you and you zoom out showing the whole context of what's going on. Sometimes it's so zoomed out that your character is like a tiny speck, like one pixel, whereas it started out as maybe 30 pixels before. You can hardly even see it, but it's still one cut. And it's impressive how they managed to handle all that scale within a fairly tightly designed game.
Yep. No, I think it's a great little experience. Only 3 hours or so. There is the sequel you mentioned, but it's one point where you run across some creatures during the game, which put me in mind of these sort of bison-looking creatures. It reminded me of a game called Hurdling that came out last year. Turns out, of course, same designers. That's their most recent game, which I think is actually 3D. I'm not sure if it's in the same setting, but it has a similar sort of vibe, I think, traveling along with this sort of herd of creatures. So quite curious to check that out and see how it compares.
Awesome. Yeah, interesting games, that series. All right, shall I jump into mine? I have a bit of a longer talk about one game.
What have you been playing?
All right, so this is a new game, or newer game to me, in a series that I played before, I've covered on the show before. This is a Tales game, a JRPG. This is, the title I played is Tales of Graces F Remastered, and I played it on the Nintendo Switch Lite. This is a remaster, of course, as you might imagine, of a 2009 Wii game, and as I understand it, that was a Japan-only title. So, North American audiences wouldn't have been able to play it at that time, but I think it did get translated later onto other platforms as well.
Probably fan's translation, if nothing else.
For sure, yeah. But I think, there was decent amount of interest in JRPGs, definitely in the 2010s.
Where does this fit into the series? I know there's a Tales series, it's the Trails series. I get those two confused as they're both getting remastered fairly regularly.
Those are different series from different publishers. The Tales of, and I guess it's the Tales of series officially, games are from Namco Bandai, or Bandai Namco. They changed places every 5 years, it feels like. And they have been going themselves for about 25 years. I think the earliest one came out on the Super Nintendo or the Super Famicom in Japan. Tales of Phantasia, if I'm not mistaken. And that's been re-released and remastered a couple times itself. So Tales of Graces F was kind of the middle period there. So that was already 16, 17 years ago at this point. And it does feel a little bit dated. But thankfully, because it's an older game, it does run very smoothly and handily on the already outdated Switch 1 hardware that I played it on. But you can play this on other platforms as well. PlayStation 4, 5, Xbox platforms, and Windows also. So what is the Tales series? So the Trails series you were asking about is a very distinct shared universe where all the titles take place in the same world at roughly the same time. And a lot of them have to do with these kind of like warring nations and then these kind of battle academies or in one case, the Trails games I'm playing, the Trails to the Sky series. Legend, the full title is The Legend of Heroes Trails to the Sky. So in that one, you are part of this like kind of like these junior cops that are kind of rough and ready, and they're like kind of like Texas Rangers style. They go from place to place and solve problems and do quests for people and ultimately try and keep the peace and do quests. So that's Legend of Heroes, but we're talking about Tales. The Tales games are essentially not related to each other at all. They're kind of more like the mainline Final Fantasy games, where each mainline entry is its own story, its own world, its own cast of characters. And like Final Fantasy, there have been a couple of games that have direct sequels. So I believe Tales of Zillia, for instance, has a 1 and 2, but most of them do not. So you can essentially jump into any one of those without having to worry about kind of the play order. And then they don't even have a number, so that helps you keep straight which one is older or newer. So I didn't really know where I was jumping in on this one. Doesn't really matter. The game I covered before was Tales of Symphonia, which was a GameCube game. And it also felt dated, but it was a real strong game. And I think our previous guest host, Alex, was a big fan of that one. And he encouraged me to get back into it and finish it and play it till the end. And it was really worthwhile. Excellent game. That was really a game that kept surprising me for being longer and longer and longer than I expected it to. I thought it was going to be, you know, a 30-hour game or something like that. And then they just kept giving you more.
Sweet summer child. You've played JRPGs. More. You know how this works.
Yeah, but there are some that are shorter. I don't know. I guess I just assumed that this was one of those. Anyways, this game is a little bit different in some ways. They generally have these kind of bright, colorful, very, you know, anime-inspired casts and character art. Definitely more like 2D oriented character artwork than like the Final Fantasy games. You know, kind of the Final Fantasy key art often like already looks 3D, right? Especially in the newer ones, kind of post Final Fantasy VII or so. But these ones, they still look very much like anime cel shaded, and they have also famously had a lot of cel animated intro movies that look really good, and also a kind of J-pop theme song that from a, like a popular artist or J-rock band that go with it. So that's been part of their legacy as well. So this story starts off with this cast of kids in this fantasy world, and it's very, very kind of pastoral. And this intro sequence went on for so long that I thought they were going to stay kids forever, because they're typically not kids. They're typically like young adults or maybe like teens getting into their adult era. But they're usually featuring adults. But this intro sequence went on for so long that I thought it was never going to end. And then it was very pastoral and kind of like saccharine and stereotypical. I was getting a little bit sick of it, to be honest. And then there's a decided tone shift where like a 7-year span happens. Things go down and some characters get separated, and then they meet back together when they're older and a little bit wiser. And that is when the story really unfurls. And I like how there's some mystery there. I like how there's some unexpected directions that the characters get pulled in. For instance, there's a pair of siblings who get separated early on and then eventually live different lives, being adopted by different houses, and they get come back together, and then they're rivals, they're enemies on other sides of a conflict. So that part Jumpy's of it.
Jumpy's utilized some pathos, I guess, and seeing sure. how things have changed.
Yeah, and that's not a new thing either. That's been used in a lot of series, but I think it's used fairly successfully here because the tone shift is quite dramatic. At first, you think it's this very lighthearted thing, and then it kind of gets into this like Game of Thrones intrigue territory. So that part of it is cool. I think I was telling you about this while we were having a meal before our last RPG session, but this game does a strange thing where before anything starts, this is the first screen you see after you press start. They say, hey, you have 1500 magic bucks. Would you like to unlock some of these kind of tweaks? And I was like, what are these? And let me just give you like a few examples of them. Would you like to do 5 times more damage than usual? Would you like to spend 20% less MP magic points to cast arts or spells, as they're called? Arts, as they're called in this series. And I thought that was very, very strange. Maybe the game version that I played is like a special edition or something, where they unlocked some of these cheats and tweaks after an initial release.
Well, especially with a remaster, these games will often introduce sort of new accessibility options or quality of life features, considering these games used to be were so long and grindy that it would find various ways to sand that down a bit, I guess. And a lot of it is presented as like difficulty or accessibility options, but sometimes it's not really clear what the designed experience is here, right? Are you just are you customizing your experience, or are you just removing all friction from the game?
Yeah, some of those effects I understood fairly well, just numerically, but others I couldn't really understand because it's a strange option to give before you even play 1 minute of the game to do that. I would understand it a little bit better if it was something like Symphony of the Night, where it had those dials that you can turn on and off whenever.
As you unlock them.
Yeah, throughout the course of the game, like some of those things you could very consciously disable just to give yourself a little bit more of a challenge. And I don't think that's the case here. I think when you unlock it, at the beginning of the game, it's unlocked.
Can't change it.
Okay. And I don't think you can change it, which was very strange. Anyways, they gave me so many of those magic bucks that I decided to go to the buffet and I turned them all on. And I think that's okay because in my opinion, the Tales games have never had the best combat system. They are generally kind of these real-time button-mashing kind of nonsense. I think it's like a little bit more akin to the Star Ocean series, where they were trying to riff off of Final Fantasy's active time battle thing, which obviously was popularized by games like, you know, Final Fantasy VI and VII, and eventually morphed into entirely action games now. They aren't turn-based at all in Final Fantasy.
Yeah, the one Tales game I played, I think it was like Berseria or Vesperia, one of those, had almost like a fighting game. Like you go into an arena and like you're moving around in relation to the other characters, like one-on-one fighting game. This is not like that at all, I presume?
It's an earlier version of that. Okay. It is a very much more button-mashy version of that. Mm. And Berseria and Vesperia are a little bit more closer to the newer titles. And the one exception to the Tales of game battle systems that I dislike is Arise, which is the very latest, I believe.
Oh, maybe that's what I played.
And I think it's actually pretty solid in Arise. Mm. They've tweaked it so that you feel like the actions that you take actually matter. The movement that you perform actually matters. It's a little bit strategic. You get to see the immediate results. It feels a little bit less button mashy and a little bit more consequential. So I think in Arise, they've done it fairly well. If you've never played Arise, it's a little bit more akin to, like, say, the real-timey action in the Final Fantasy VII Remaster series. So it makes it a little bit more dynamic. But the earlier ones, not good. I think it was fine to avoid them. And in this case, I basically automate everything. I put the characters on auto attack, which you can adjust their styles. So you can tweak characters to be more support, more long range, more offensive, more melee. And you were able to do that even in Symphonia. So you were able to automate them earlier on. And I think that's just as good because the battles are annoying. Just get them out of the way. And with the automation and with those tweaks that I unlocked, most combats can be over in like less than 10 seconds. So kind of annoying that they still happen, but at least they're over with quick and you still get to see your characters grow. And I think that's fine. I think though real-time random battle systems are a little bit long on the tooth. I'm not sure if I'm entirely willing to get rid of them, but I appreciate more of the modern takes that newer game systems have done. Games like, you know, the Persona and Metaphor make it a little bit more interesting to play with the comboing and the elemental effects. What do you think about those?
These old JRPGs don't really have a lot of strategic depth, really. It's all about endurance more than actual tactics, really. Like some of the Dragon Quest games I've been playing and Final Fantasy. I mean, obviously, if you are playing on easy mode with all those options that you turned on, I mean, if you're removing some of that friction, that's sometimes all that's there, right? It's like, how far can you make it? If you've removed even that, like, and it's just this seamless grindy experience, like, I don't know, there's not much left to actually enjoy. If it is at least in that real time sort of action button pressing thing and like timing things potentially, I don't know, is there much to do moment to moment?
Well, there has been, like I said, there has been automation even from the earlier days. So with a real-time combat system, it's hard to control everyone with a party of four on screen at once. So typically you would control your main character and the rest of the characters would be automated and you might swap between them. Maybe you would take control of one character. It's more like kind of cruise control, and you take control when you need it of a specific character. So that has always been the case here. And in this one, I kind of feel like I did 70 hours or whatever of that with Symphonia, and I kind of had my fill. And I decided to sidestep that entirely. And I think that's an interesting choice because JRPG fans, I think, come in different stripes. There are ones that like the strategic battling, and some JRPGs are specifically strategy games, like your Final Fantasy Tactics or your things like your Metaphor. So that's one direction. But there are also JRPG fans that are things like, you know, just are there for the drama, right? They just want to see the characters smooch or whatever. You know, like your Final Fantasy VIII fans or things like that. You know, there's people that come to JRPGs for a lot of different reasons. So let me tell you about some of the other things that you might get attracted to, and we can decide at the end whether there is a reason to stick around for this adventure. So other things that are good of this game are the story. I told you about how the story goes in interesting places. The game, the graphics are quite serviceable. You can tell that they're older, but this game has a kind of like a lovely like pastel color palette to it. So it feels quite vibrant, even though the world is essentially kind of this like Euro fantasy told through the Japanese lens. Pretty kind of trite and typical stuff with your kind of military forces vying for taking control of each other, like factions will typically do. So what else can be said about this game that makes it unique? Well, I think that one thing that makes it stand apart from the other entries in the series is that the ones that I played most intensely, Symphonia, the dungeons were actually a real highlight of that game. Each dungeon featured a unique sort of gameplay gimmick. So essentially the main character of that game had this kind of like ring, and the ring had a basic like shoot effect that you could shoot real time while you're traversing the dungeon before you even enter into a combat, because it's a game where you hit an enemy and then a separate combat screen starts. This one, you could actually shoot off your ring and temporarily like freeze enemies in real time before those battles started. And at certain spots, there would be like a station where you would interact in a dungeon, and then it will enable the gimmick for that one dungeon. So in that one dungeon, it might be turn your ring into like an electrified field so that you can disable mechanical equipment or like electrify enemies. And another one might be shoot off a bubble so that you can capture an enemy into a bubble and kind of trap them so that they're not a threat anymore. And it might even trigger some puzzle element in the dungeon.
Yeah, so is there like a, more of a navigational puzzle or like solving... Are you solving a trick here, or is it like platforming?
Absolutely. every dungeon in a Symphonia was more akin to a game like Ocarina of Time than it is to just like a gauntlet of battles that you had to get through, like another typical JRPG. You know, like I feel like the Persona games have this slightly, you know, like Persona 5 had like a little bit of like platforming challenges. Or they would even have the jumping through the paintings in the Madarame's castle sequence, if you remember that.
I've been playing Dragon Warrior 7, and it's got Sokoban puzzles in the middle of dungeons.
Yeah, and I will come back to Sokoban later. So essentially in Symphonia, I felt like every dungeon, I looked forward to it. It's like, this one, how is this different from the one before? And there were like dozens of dungeons in there, and they were so innovative and so cleverly designed and satisfyingly designed from a puzzle and gameplay and story perspective that they never seemed like a chore. This game, on the other hand, is the complete opposite. The dungeons, when they're there, there's very few of them. When they are there, they're fairly linear. There's a very, very distinctive waypoint marker everywhere. Overworld map, and even within dungeons. So finding your way to the exit is never a challenge in this game. And even on the overworld, there is, you generally have very little reason to deviate from the linear path. Maybe there might be a treasure chest 2 steps off the path over here, or 3 steps off the path over there. And when you can diverge from the main path, they will block you from it if it's not appropriate for when the story, where the story is at.
So you're just going through the motions, and basically
you are following the waypoints, going through the motions and triggering the next cutscene. And because the dungeons are not cleverly designed, the overworld is not cleverly designed, the story is not terribly innovative. Maybe the story might be the best part of this game, and the combat is outright regressive. I think there's very little to recommend about this entry into the series, and I think it's a true regression from the heights of some of the greater titles in that series, like Abyss, I enjoyed very much. I first played that on the Nintendo 3DS. That one has great characters, great gameplay. Symphonia is just fantastic. And Arise is quite a solid entry that somehow hasn't managed to hook me, but looks great, plays great.
It sounds like maybe there's a reason why this one wasn't localized originally. I mean, obviously, it's a lot of work to localize a JRPG. I don't know if Japanese audiences have different expectations of the amount of grind that are in these games. It sounds like a lot of squeeze for a little bit of juice.
I think it's just a kind of like a, I don't know, it's just one of the middle entries in a long-running series. Not all of them are going to be hits. This is basically more like a, you know, Final Fantasy 13 than it was a Final Fantasy 7 or 10. You know, some of them just don't work out. And I think there are some interesting entries in the series that do quirky things that people don't always love, like a Final Fantasy 12. But this one is one that they just really phoned it in and didn't try very hard. So Tales of Graces F, the remaster for the Nintendo Switch, I can't strongly recommend it. I'm probably just going to keep playing it just to have the story. But, you know, if you're enjoying this just for the story and the character twists and the plot, then you might as well just watch an anime series. Like, there's no reason why you have to keep pressing A to go through the battles. No reason why you have to go through an overworld to find treasure chests. There are a couple of things that this game does okay. The crafting system is very basic, is serviceable. There are side quests, but the side quests are basically like, give me some you know, cherry pies or give me some rice balls or whatever. Styles, yeah. These are things that you were already generating or collecting anyway. Super uninspired. And you compared this game to the Trails series before. I think the Trails series does fantastic things, really interesting things gameplay-wise, story-wise. The stakes are much more compelling. The characters are more interesting, at least in the Trails to the Sky ones that I've played.
There was a remake of the first game that came out last year.
Yeah, there's actually been two remakes of Trails to the Sky. So this would be the second remake. So can't say much good about Tales of Graces F, so I would avoid that one. For some reason, I'm going to punish myself and keep playing it for a little bit, see how it goes.
Committed to do. Okay.
Back to you.
Well, my game of this week is called Dispatch, a video game that came out last year. It was released over October to November 2025 because this was an episodic game. I discussed this briefly sometime last year, but it was a demo before it was released. It left a really strong impression on me, but it's only just recently I finally got around to playing the full thing. I mentioned episodic games there. This is made by a lot of veterans of Telltale games. Specifically, I believe Tales from the Borderlands, one of my personal favorites. Mark, were you familiar with the Telltale games much?
I played a smattering of them here and there. I played through most of, but not all of, the Tales, Walking Dead, of course. That was a massive hit for them, those entries. And I, too, also really enjoyed Tales from the Borderlands. One of the sleeper best Borderlands games.
Absolutely.
Despite not being a first-person shooter whatsoever, it really kind of expanded upon the universe. And it has some great laugh-out-loud moments and fantastic characters in its own right. And yeah, a lot of those weren't in the other games.
And I think this is a similar analogs here. And this is obviously in a new IP, a superhero setting that's similarly irrelevant, very jokey and edgy, a lot of nudity and swearing, but also brings in a lot of heart. Like I've been wondering about, I'm so burnt out on superheroes. I've not seen a Marvel film in years. Even the sort of dark and edgy superheroes like your The Boys and Invincible, I've really struggled to work up any motivation for that. And I've been trying to figure out why is this different. And I think there's a fine line to toe between being irreverent but still being sincere at the same time. That's hard to pull off. And I think this largely does it. And so it has this sort of raw humanity, and like it is willing to stop and have heartfelt moments at the same time. And so this is, I mean, basically you're playing a superhero. Well, a hero who has a superpowered suit. You don't actually have any powers yourself, but you have lost your suit essentially, and you've basically, but through contrivances, are now working at a superhero dispatch center. And so there's basically this team of ex-villains. It's a little bit like the juvenile delinquent program, a little bit like there's an old British show called Misfits that was literally juvenile delinquents with superheroes. That was a lot of fun.
I watched that.
And this has some similar vibes here, where there's sort of the sense of like these characters being redeemed. But it's a great sense of banter between all of these characters. Like they're all voiced by, most of the voice actors are people from Critical Role, which I'm not particularly familiar with. It's a Critical Role production, and there's people from that group and other. Actors like Aaron Paul and Jeffrey Wright. It's a pretty strong cast. The performances across the line are all pretty great. Animation is great. Like this does not look like a game. It looks like a pre-rendered cutscene. It looks like an animation for most of the game. Apparently, it was originally envisioned as a live action at one point, and then as an animation, and then finally as a game. So you can see that history there. They've got a good sense of cinematography and how everything is played out and framed, and it's all pretty seamless between the sort of gameplay moments and the just cutscene moments. And so one thing that will stand out here is that this is actually more gamey than most of those Telltale games. It's like the actual dispatch moments where you have like this simulation layer of sending the heroes out to various events, like, is much more gaming than any of those Telltale games, which was largely just walk around and talk to people, sometimes some light puzzles. That always felt a little bit contrived and like not really, like, it's just there to say that it's a game, right? It's never really felt beholden, never felt like we were fully committing to the bit of just tell an interesting story. You don't need to prove that you're a game, right? I mean, virtual novels have been doing this for how long now? And I mean, that's partly, I think, what it comes down to is, like, I don't know that it fully reconciles some of the choices that you're given. Most of the choices come down to a relationship with a specific character. I don't want to spoil anything here, but, like, there is a romance. You have the choice to romance a couple of characters, and one of those characters has a lot of options as to, like, how you're going to encourage them or how many chances you're going to give them, basically. Are you going to romance them in various things? And I made various choices. I was consistent with choices regarding this character, and then got to the end, and the game basically said, no, you neglected them. Like, that, you get the bad ending. And that was a bit deflating, because basically it gives you, like, this binary choice, or it's basically binary check. Like, did you do enough of these things to get the good ending? Otherwise, you get the bad ending. And I think that was a bit... putting so many factors into one decision, I think, was a little bit... I don't know, there was thumbing the scale a little bit too much, and it gives too many opportunities for disparity in how you play the game and how... those decisions that play out. And I think, like, these games are tough to do setup and payoff when it's trying to accommodate four decisions. I think that's one thing that they've always struggled with. I think people have derided this illusion of choice. Oh, well, you make all these choices and it all comes back to the same ending. And I don't know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, as long as you feel in the moment that, like, you were being part of this story and having inputs, I don't think it matters if it really... As long as you don't see the code, right? I think you can still be in the moment and experience that setup and payoff. It's when it breaks down that things don't feel bad. I mean, to bounce back to the actual gameplay, I think that's one of the other real highlights of this game, in that you are sending out these characters on these missions. It'll be like, oh, a cat is stuck in a tree. Which of these eight heroes are you going to send out to rescue it? And basically it'll give you a brief description. It's like, you need a hero to get there fast, and you need someone who can climb a tree, and a little bit it'll highlight certain features. And all these characters are basically broken down into five stats, like the health, their strength, the defense, their speed, their intelligence, and like communications, like how well they can convince people. And you basically have to interpret those clues which hero is going to be best, because then it will give you a scale. It's like, after they get there, it'll present, okay, you needed a hero with three strength and five speed. And like it's this really complicated graph of the 5-point graph, and it overlays what they wanted from you and versus this hero, and this ball is bouncing around the middle, and there's this real sort of gambling, will it land in the right spot or not. It's a lot of like pizzazz for like this fairly simple mechanic that it's cute. I tried to overthink it. Like, I don't think at any moment you had a lot enough decisions or tools to really think about this game strategically. I largely just tried to live in the moment. What it does do really well is force you to like think about these characters and what they do well, who is best for a particular mission, and like learn, like, you basically, as a real dispatcher, you want to like learn who these characters are and play them to their strengths. Some missions will have, like, if you basically, like, there's a fire. If you send Water Boy out there, he's probably going to have a better chance to put out the fire, right? So you want to encourage you to get to know your team and work with them. And I think it does build up a sense of rapport really well. There's banter going back and forth between these heroes. They're sort of riffing on each other and insulting each other and insulting you quite regularly over the course of this. I think it does set up this good sense of, even if the gameplay isn't particularly strong by itself, it does set up this really good sort of narrative gameplay loop. Like, whatever the opposite of ludonarrative dissonance is, it's like it's the good version of that. Like, they are working in communication with each other really well. It's like when you first start out, everyone's fighting and they're not getting along, they're sabotaging each other, and missions are failing, and it's communicating those character relationships through gameplay in quite effective ways. And gradually they you know, they start to get along and things go smoother. And I think it communicates, like, it utilizes difficulty to communicate something about the game, about state of the characters, without like it actually being difficult, largely. which I think it does really well. The exception there being there are some, like, it's a hacking minigame, which is pretty by the books. Like, it's you have to, like, navigate this grid and unlock sort of quick time puzzles. And some of that does get to the point where it's just difficult for the sake of being difficult. And it's trying a little bit hard to be a game. I think mini games like that can be really useful for, like, building immersion and a sense of, like, bringing you into the game and being part of that moment. But I think you can have friction without it being actually difficult and with hard fail states. I think they didn't quite toe the line there. There's some quick time events in cutscenes as well that, like, I'd be enjoying a cutscene and suddenly there's a quick time event. I'd fumble it because I was invested in the cutscene. I want to watch the cutscene. I think you can turn those off, and I'd probably recommend doing that to anyone who's interested. I don't think they really added anything in the grand scheme of things. So, I mean, I did really enjoy this. I think the story overall is great, other than the final ending, I think, was a little bit of a downer to me. I think they pulled a couple of punches. There was a setup for a real... I mean, if you've played Tales from the Borderlands, which had the catch-a-ride moments, if you know, if you played that, you'll know what I mean. There's a similar scene here, which is set up really well, and then they sort of pull their punch at the end. I want them to commit to the bit a little bit more, but I think it's a really fantastic first stab at this. It's a unique take on superheroes and this sort of gameplay, this narrative sort of gameplay. So I think it's a really strong first entry and trying something different. I'm curious to see how they evolve that. Didn't quite stick the landing for me, but it's an excellent first punch.
Very cool. I'm certainly intrigued about Dispatch. I can't say that it's a genre that I love so much that I was willing to jump on at full price, but people have generally, I've heard nothing but good things, good enough things, and you know, people know I like studios that try stuff, trying to tweak the formula to see if they can get an interesting result.
Totally. And I should say, I also played on Switch, which is censored for some reason. There has been some controversy over that. Like, the language isn't censored, but they dropped, like, there's black bars on all of the nudity, which feels, I mean, the nudity in itself feels a bit much. But, like, there's one scene, like, a character flips the middle finger, and they there's a black bar over that. Like, if you can't even show that, I mean, it feels a bit much. I don't know.
Nintendo being the kiddie system yet again.
Yeah.
That just continues. Even though they have all those hentai games that are listed on their store.
Well, yeah.
Dozens AI of them.
Hentai is like half of the eShop right now.
That's right. Slop. AI slop has reached all platforms possible. Speaking of reaching an interesting conclusion, shall we talk about dessert?
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. My topic is not really a media for consumption, although it does involve media. Mine is a software platform. So I could probably talk at length about this, but I'm going to save it because people probably don't want their ears to bleed. Suffice it to say, I've been trying to set up a home server set up to essentially home lab. And for those who are unaware, home labbing is just kind of like a loose umbrella term for kind of setting up your own gear, serving your own stuff, rather than paying companies to do it for you.
Going off grid.
Kind of, except very much on a grid. For sure. This is not roughing it at all. So I tried many things. Essentially, I bought this TerraMaster NAS, a 2-bay NAS, about 6 months ago. And it took me about 2 or 3 months even to get work up the courage to, like, set it up. And my inspiration was, I'm sick of paying Google all this money to store my photos. I'm sick of paying this company all this money to serve me digital music. This company has served me digital videos. Whatever, what have you.
All decentralized, right?
Yes, and basically all bleeding me dry while somehow not owning anything. So I wanted to do it for myself. So I think setting up a NAS is the right concept, but there isn't a really good entry point to get on there. So I bought this built NAS hardware, which is essentially a low-powered computer. It's essentially a low-powered Linux-based computer that has multiple slots for drive bays. And that's the key concept I wanted to do, is I wanted to have a RAID. And a RAID is like an array of hard drives that will create copies of themselves. So a RAID array can be two drives upwards to like 16 drives. So essentially, this is to avoid a situation where you put all your precious family photos for, you know, whatever, a dozen years of your child's life growing up or whatever, you know, photos from your pre-wedding era, precious memories, precious data. And then turns out that, you know, the hard drive you're storing it on is just shot. Well, you want to avoid that situation.
Sounds like a glorified backup, basically.
Well, it is a backup.
Yeah.
It's not glorified. That's literally
it's very complicated
what
way
it
of
is.
Having a backup, yeah.
I mean, no, it's a very straightforward and logical way of setting up a backup. It copies the drive one-to-one on a regular basis. Couldn't be harder than that. And that's what a RAID array is. I knew I wanted to set that up. I just didn't know how to go about it. This NAS, I cannot recommend. It did not work out for me. It was complicated and frustrating. And I know that probably people that do know their NASs will say, well, there's all these other brands. There's Synology, there's Ugreen, there's QNAP or whatever. There's plenty of them. But what I came to the realization was, is that these are just low powered computers. And I know how computers work, so I thought I would grab, I have a couple old laptops, I would install some Linux distros on those, and I experimented that for a couple more months, and found some interesting results, until fairly recently where I learned about two OS options that were very interesting. Because I cracked that code and realized that NAS's network accessible storage hardware are just low powered computers, that I could just install the software on any computer. And I have old computer gear kicking around. So the OSs I found first, the first one was called Umbrella OS. So Umbrella, like umbrella. I saw a YouTube video about it. And from what I could see, it looks very slick. It looks like very much like an Apple product. It looks like, you know, kind of like the iCloud software, and it runs just as slick, maybe even a little bit more slick in some capacity. And while I am a tweaker of hardware, and I have no problem with, you know, installing various versions of Linux or other softwares, I even dabble in the command line at sometimes. That's not my real preference. I'm still more of a, you know, like a visual UI based person. So Umbrella OS really appealed to me for that reason, because it's very much like graphical interface. There's an app store. You download these very, very easy to use apps, and they will run your own version of popular software like, you know, Plex for serving up your media. There's the other flavors as well. There's Jellyfin and things like that. I really enjoy the software called Kavita. Kavita for serving up ebooks. I have a large collection of legally acquired ebooks that I've purchased over the years from places like Humble Bundle, where they'll sell you, you know, 30 books at once, or all these bundles of comic books, so, and manga and whatever from Kodansha. I have tons of those, so much that I didn't want to transfer those file by file over to an iPad every time I updated a new one. So Umbrella was very appealing, but sadly Umbrella has a lot of dodgy crypto software on the platform. And this is open source, by the way. Most of the software I'm talking to you about are like projects from various corners of the internet that they've just kind of collected, and they're still open source. You can still install them command line. And just like the percentage of them seemed strangely leaning towards crypto and AI, two things which I personally not terribly attracted to. So I tried another option, which was very similar to Umbrella, which is called Zima OS. I actually mentioned Zima OS in the intro to the last episode, didn't really explain it very well. So here's the explanation. Zima OS, what is it? It's formerly called Kazaa OS. It's essentially an OS for PCs, and it runs everything that Umbrella OS can do and more. It has more software options. It does note-taking software like Obsidian, which is something that I was already very interested in. It does audiobook hosting. It does, what's the other one that was really interesting to me? I mentioned Kavita already. Image, it sounds like the word image, but it's I-M-M-I-C-H, is basically like a run your own Google Photos. I definitely needed an option for that, for not just for myself, but for things like my wife and my kid. You know, we have these precious memories that we're wanting to collect with all our various digital devices. I don't want to keep paying Google all this money to store all our photos for infinity years.
Chronically at 99%, you know, cap on my Google Photos. Like, which precious photo of my child am I going to delete next?
Exactly. I never wanted to do that. And I also didn't want to trust Google to do that for me, or Apple, whatever their service is called. I forget, whatever the service they also charge you through the teeth to use. I didn't want to pay either. I wanted to own it. And I know that this isn't bulletproof. It's still a good idea to have an offline backup of your backups because, well, what if your house burns down? Doesn't matter how many drives you have that are backups of each other if it's all in the one house that burns down. So you still want a copy of this. I'm working on that eventually. But let me just say that I'm super satisfied with Zima OS. There's kind of like no limits to what it can do. It's serving all of my various media very well. And the next thing I want to try is to set up a ROM server. So basically, rather than individually loading up my ROMs or managing it in different folders where I name things badly, I can have like a very like UI focused collection of my ROMs for my various retro game platforms. And I can instantly search up what year this is from or what's the sequel to that series or whatever. Very interested to try that out. So for a tinkerer like myself, this is a real pleasure. And if I would recommend that if someone is like a novice, but you've installed like a version of Windows before on a laptop, try downloading Zima. It doesn't cost you anything. It'll run on old stuff. And it's really quite slick and cool. I personally installed it on a mini tower, mostly so that I would have multiple drive bays. Because my solution was to install the OS on an SSD and then store the actual media on older disk-based drives, which are sold specifically to run in NAS hardware. They're intended to run like 24 hours a day even, and they're like built, purpose-built for that. So I actually had to buy extra PCIe hardware to support multiple drives, but they physically fit in my drive bay, so I was happy about that. Anyways, this was a 6-month journey for me. So that's why I'm so kind of enthused about it, because it was a very, you know, kind of hard struggle for me to figure out. But I'm super pleased now. Like, it's just running, and I don't think about it every day, and it just works. So I know you're always talking about ease of use. Me, I don't mind the tinkering. And when I set it up for myself, I'm happy because then I can forget about it. Then I gain the benefits and I don't have to keep paying through the teeth.
Well, you lost me at NAS, but I know we have a lot of tech-savvy listeners out there who I'm sure are always looking for new options. So, I mean, that's assuming you can afford hard drives, which is easier said than done right now.
Well, hard drives are cheaper than years of paying for Google Drive space. Let me tell you, once you reach into the multiple terabyte levels, you're paying multiple hundreds of dollars per year. And the hardware, especially having the old computer parts lying around, is much cheaper than that, buying it once.
Sid, I'm seeing hard drives basically selling at market rate now. Like, you could use, it's like you go to the seafood shop and it's the market price of fish. Now the hard drives are variable because it's changing so rapidly.
You have to ask your maitre d' for the freshest hard drives available. Anyways, I'm done with my hardware talk. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'll be quick. I had a few things that I've started that I'm not quite ready to talk about yet. So I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about until the last minute. But I think I'm going to talk about a little comic book called Saga of the Swamp Thing. Is this a character that you're familiar with at all, Mark?
No, I have heard of it kind of all through my life. I knew there was a film. And the film was based on a Dark Horse comic, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe all of them are Dark Horse comics.
They're actually DC.
Oh, really?
Surprisingly. So, like, the one that I'm reading, the Justice League did show up very briefly and were quite ineffectual. But this is written by Alan Moore. It was part of a reboot of the character in 1982. It was originally rebooted with a different creative team, but then Alan Moore was brought on along with, Stephen R. Bissett and John Totleben. And it's curious because you pick up volume one of the Saga of Swamp Thing, and it starts with issue 20. And like there's like a dozen characters, and there's a big fight. This has ended. Swamp Thing is dead. It's thrown right into the middle of it. But I mean, obviously, with a lot of these comics, they do set you up, and they want to be able to bring in new readers. So again, Alan Moore, I've discussed previously V for Vendetta. I also read From Hell last year. These were all covered by the Shelf by Genre podcast. And I mean, I'm conflicted on Alan Moore because like I love some of the ideas. I feel a lot of it's just a little bit gratuitous, especially in some of the violence and treatment of women, and also the mysticism. I can't keep up with it. I mean, talk about enjoying things you don't understand. I think Alan Moore takes it a little bit beyond in trying to keep all of these magical ideas in your head. But I think this is towing a really good line so far. I think something about being in DC and sort of brings it down to earth. I mean, obviously appropriate for a plant creature. It's a little more grounded, but it is also like still very, it's a very interior story. A lot of like interior monologue, like dream sequences, and like some things like dead and dreaming inside the swamp, and it's a very psychological story, and even starts dipping into some like cosmic horror in some really fun ways. I said Superman shows up at one point and doesn't really do anything. So it's very much this story of something, and in a very small personal stories, and some of the psychological drama and senses of identity. And yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say so far. It's what I'm really enjoying though is the artwork. I think it's a very, to look at it at a glance, it is very dated artwork. It's got that very simple, sketchy sort of cross-hatching instead of like strong lines. Very simple color scheme. Like a frame might only have two or three colors, but used for really strong effect in the terms of contrast and highlighting and just some beautiful composition. There's some really, like the framing of some of the action scenes, really, really creative, and then the framing is really done really well. That I find myself like just staring at a page for quite a bit of time, absorbing all these details. So I think they do a lot with a little by the sort of that old school DC comic style. I mean, I'm not particularly familiar with superheroes. As I was just saying, I'm fairly disillusioned with superheroes broadly, so I can't say how standard this was, if this was like really setting a different tone for what was standard at the time. I don't know if you have any experience with the old Superman or Batman or things like that.
I do on and off, but I think I'm in the more like the middle period. Like I read, like lots of people did. I read, Frank Miller's Batman series. What is it? The Dark Knight Returns.
Yes.
Really, really popular, and that had a sequel. And so I like how DC, I guess the reason why I thought it was Dark Horse is because DC is seemingly willing to try more things in kind of like darker spaces. And I know that, Marvel comic fans will always say, hey, we've done our horror series too. You know, we've done our whatever Ghost Riders and our Morbiuses and things like that. But it seems like DC always like felt more comfortable into those darker spaces. And I feel like the Vertigo line, the Vertigo line.
Yeah.
I forget. Is Sandman DC or is that?
I think so.
Dark Horse. Sure. Yeah. They seem to kind of court that side of the darker aspect, kind of horror adjacent pieces, more psychologically intriguing things that are not just like capes and heroes. And I guess that's why like I never really got into Swamp Thing, is because it doesn't really seem like a typical superhero capes and costumes kind of.
No, it is definitely it's hard to even explain, having read the first volume, like how is he a hero? Like he's just largely like he punches a villain like once. There's very little fighting in this. It's very much a battle of the minds so far, and just exploring themes of identity. And I'm still trying to get a grip on it, but it's compelling nevertheless.
Yeah, and I think the important thing to remember, it's sort of in the long history of American comics, like there was a period that had more than capes and superheroes, right? Like they had detective comics, they had Western comics, they had romance comics. So maybe like we think too little of the publishers now, like Marvel and DC, and kind of boil them down to they should just be superheroes punching each other in tights, when really they promised a lot more before. And the the medium was vibrant enough to offer more disparate and varied stories before. And perhaps, you know, Swamp Thing was just a natural kind of wing of that more popular platform at the time.
I mean, you talked earlier about sort of lore. I mean, I think Marvel, our current idea of like the MCU is like one of the quintessential concepts of like capital C canon and lore, and like all very locked down and sterile. But I think back in the day, these comics were like pretty wide, like given to like so many different creatives spread wide across so many different characters and sub stories within this world, that there was probably quite a lot of bit of inconsistency and different takes and different visions, and like creators were just given rein to do what they like within this their own little corner of this world.
Yeah, and like comics have natural differences in tone anyways, and it's probably more like the crossover series, like the Civil Wars and the Secret Wars and what have you, that are more prone to have weird dissonance in merging heroes that really shouldn't kind of hang out together, you know, like the Hell's Kitchen characters, you know, the
right,
the Jessica Joneses and the Daredevils.
They have a very different scale of heroism, like the ground level Street Fighters versus the cosmic heroes.
Exactly. They're supposed to exist in the same universe, but like the kind of the tier at which they fight is very different, and the kind of the scope of combat that they fight is very different. So the types of stories you can tell can also be different, even though somehow they're all connected.
Excellent. But yeah, I'm enjoying my first foray into DC Comics. So if you have any other recommendations, let me know.
Very cool. Well, I think we've talked at length there, but I'm pleased that we continue to kind of stretch the limits of the media that's out there. You know, stretch it for ourselves, obviously. We're not entering new territory for a lot of people out there, but it's new to us, so it's fun to explore.
Certainly. There's been some discussion today on social media about this concept of limiting what games can be, and like games made by gamers. And again, I think I've discussed this before, but like this a canonical sense of this is what a game is, this is what this subgenre is. And I think I'm always more interested in blowing the definition open. That's when you get new ideas and new experiences.
That's right. And I guess that crossing genres is what the Omni Gamers Club has been about as well. We absolutely like to see where things kind of bend over the edge and twist over. And obviously all the other types of media we cover also have close connections to the video games and tabletop games that we play, because these things aren't created in a vacuum.
And ultimately, I think it just comes down to staying curious, like be open-minded to like the full breadth of what games can be. So yeah, I think we'll hopefully continue to do that.
Yeah, and reach out, tell us what we should be playing and listening to and watching. And Daniel, maybe we can tell the people what we're up to and how to reach out.
Yes, yeah. Well, if you have any questions or comments on today's episodes, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club. You can find us on Blue Sky, the Omnigamers Club account there, and myself at Board Game Feast, also on Blue Sky.
That's right. Go check us out on YouTube, where we post videos of our episodes, the new ones as they go out. If you're interested in checking out our back catalog, our oldest episodes are in audio form only, so you'll have to go to a podcatcher like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever for that. And on those platforms, please like and share the videos, share the podcasts with people you know who might be interested in it, and leave comments, because you know we don't charge anything for this, but it feels very rewarding to see your feedback when we receive it.
So it's always much appreciated. Social media is in its dying spasms. And so, you know, the only way people find the podcast is through word of mouth. So, you know, always appreciate it if you spread the word.
There you go. I've already jumped ship, so that's why I'm not sharing my social media addresses. Are there any other shout-outs we should give? Maybe events happening?
As I mentioned last episode, ProtoCon is coming up in November here in Vancouver. Again, I'll drop the link to that in the show notes.
Awesome. Well, folks, thanks for sticking with us for so long. More games to come, and fun stuff soon. So until next time, have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.